Well, a little over a year ago, we were at a function and I ran into an old friend that I used to attend Worldwide Church of God about 25 years ago. And at that time, they believed as we do now. They mentioned how their father kept trying to talk to their children about the Great Tribulation. And they were kind of annoyed about that because they don't believe those things anymore. And this person shocked me when they said, "There is no great tribulation," very matter-of-factly. And I was kind of stunned. At first, I thought maybe it was a joke, but it became quickly clear that they weren't joking. In their mind, the Great Tribulation was no longer real. This made me ponder how one transitions from believing something is revealed truth to believing it is a fable. My conclusion after some thought is that if a person no longer hears something preached, or they no longer read about it in God's word, then well-established truth becomes fable. In accordance to this dynamic of things not being talked about, becoming forgotten, or becoming fables, I've been thinking about the topic of the place of safety. Back in April of 2015, at that time, I had found a sermon online from Mr. Fay that was from 1980 on the subject. And I think he was in Australia at the time. And I asked him if he would consider giving that sermon again. And he wrote back excitedly about a day later. He had found his notes. They were paper notes. And he said they were a little crumpled, but they could still be read. But he was getting involved in his Daniel study quite a bit at the time, and he said he couldn't get around to it right away. And unfortunately, they were still on his desk when he passed away. So, inspired by that sermon, the last couple of months I've been researching as much as I could find on the subject, listening to sermons from Mr. Armstrong on the subject, Mr. Raymond McNair, John Okwin, and Mr. Fay, and then reading every good news that I found about it from the late 50s, early 60s. And today I'd like to kind of go through a synopsis of this material as a refresher to those who are familiar with it, who've studied the subject. And for those who aren't that familiar with the subject, hopefully today we'll cover the key scriptures to give a good understanding on the background of how the Church of God came to understand and view the subject. In doing so, we'll be better equipped to discern right from wrong in relating to ideas about the place of safety going forward. So before we begin today, let's lay some basic ground rules we need to understand or put into effect before we move forward. First, as Mr. Fay mentioned back in his Revelation series on Revelation 12, let's agree that the place of safety isn't the goal. The kingdom of God is the goal. Second, let's agree that for a Christian, the preservation of our physical lives pales in significance to obtaining spiritual salvation. As Christ said in Matthew 16:25, "Whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." Our focus as Christians is outward, desiring to be useful to God in his service for the benefit of others, not preoccupied inwardly, focusing on our own well-being or benefit. That's just the nature of Christianity. Third, just because there is a place of safety promised by God for his believers, that does not mean that some of the faithful of God may be required to lose their lives in God's service. We know that for a fact that Peter, Paul, James, and Stephen were all martyred for their belief in God. We're told that about martyrs in the church at Smyrna in Revelation 2. We're also told that saints of God, both before and after the beginning of the Great Tribulation, will lose their lives for Christ's sake. Let's see that by turning to Luke 21, verse 11. Luke chapter 21 and verse 11, and let's see that. Luke 21:11. And there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Let's drop down to verse 16. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience, possess your souls. The timeline of events, and I'm going to kind of pound on this timeline today a little bit so we understand very clearly that there will be persecution on God's church before the Great Tribulation. And here we see, we didn't read it, but in verse 20 it talks about the abomination of desolation, which commences at the beginning of the Great Tribulation. And this, what we just read about these things occurring, are occurring before that in the timeline. Great earthquakes, famine, and pestilence actually begin before the beginning of the Great Tribulation. The heavenly signs and greater martyrdom that occur in the Great Tribulation occur in the Great Tribulation, as we see in Revelation 6 is another parallel to this, showing the same timeline of events. So we see in verse 12 of Luke 21, but before all these things, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. So we understand that some of that martyrdom does occur before the Great Tribulation. However, our physical lives are not what is shown to be important to God. He says that not a hair of our head will be lost. Having patience through whatever comes about is how we will be spiritually preserved, and that's what where his focus is. Our fourth and final ground rule before we get going here is that it is not wrong to desire to escape the Great Tribulation. Let's drop down to verse 36 in Luke 21. Luke 21:36. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So Christ tells us to pray that we would be worthy to escape the Great Tribulation. We see that Jesus wants us to escape what's coming. Even those who would be martyred ahead of the Great Tribulation ultimately will escape it. But Christ introduces an element involving our escape. And that element is spiritual worthiness. We need to be close to God in our spiritual walk as a precondition to escape. We'll look at that more later. Let's keep in mind regarding our prayers to escape that Jesus prayed that his cup would pass from him, if you recall, before his physical death. However, God the Father may be working out a greater purpose for our individual lives than physical escape, as he did with Jesus. Okay, with these principles in mind, let's move forward with our topic. In order to organize this broad topic, and it was really a challenge from an organizational standpoint, I thought it might be easiest to examine it from the perspective of who, what, when, where, and why. To kind of stay on that road path, and we can get most of it out. So let's start by seeing where it comes from. Let's turn to Revelation 12, verse 12. And Revelation 12 is a condensed history of the relationship between the devil and the church of God. We're going to jump into it late in the story here, where Satan attempts to attack the church of God, called the woman, before the onset of the Great Tribulation. And we also keep in mind here in Revelation, there's two women mentioned prominently. One is the church of God. The other is the great harlot, which is the false church. Revelation 12, 12. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time. So this is later, late in the game here. Now, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Again, we see that Satan will be persecuting the church of God before the onset of the Great Tribulation, because we're told the woman will be in her place for 1260 days. That's the full duration of the Great Tribulation. God will supernaturally protect part of his church there, we're told, giving them two wings of a great eagle that they might fly into the wilderness to a specific place. In Exodus 19:4, God describes to Moses the flight out of Egypt in similar language, saying, "I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." The Hebrew for bore is lifted up and carried, but God did so by allowing them to walk out of Egypt. And notice their destination. It says they were going to be brought to himself. They were God was going to bring Israel out of Egypt to himself. Once at this specific location in the wilderness, the church will be nourished for time, times, and half a time. So this is the period of the 3.5 years or 1260 days of the Great Tribulation discussed throughout the Olivet Prophecy and three of the books there, and prophesied by Daniel the prophet in Daniel 12:7. For part of the church, they will be nourished in preparation to become part of the bride of Christ. Nourish here in the Hebrew means strengthen and fatten. According to Thayer's Bible Dictionary, it also conveys the concept, I'm sorry, that would be nourish here in Revelation is not Hebrew, of course, it's Greek. So according to Thayer's Bible Dictionary, it conveys the concept of giving suck as a nursing child. Jesus Christ, as the head of his church, will be spiritually preparing those in his care at this specific place. And we also need to notice verse 17. There is another part of the church of God that will not be under the same protection as those that we just read about. These are described as the rest of the woman's or church's offspring. The King James Version uses the word remnant. Remnant means that which is left behind. We are told these people keep the commandments of God. However, it doesn't mention that they keep the testimony of Jesus Christ. It only says they have the testimony, the words that he spoke, what he said. Part of the testimony of Christ, as we just read earlier, watch and pray that you be counted worthy to escape. If you have Christ's testimony, it means you understand it, you have access to it, but you don't necessarily live by it. The remnant appears to not be properly spiritually prepared, not living by the testimonies of Christ. We can't have the discussion of the remnant and the who in this discussion without turning to Revelation 3, verse 10. We understand that the seven churches discussed in Revelation 2 and 3 represent three different things. First, they represented seven different churches which all existed simultaneously in Asia Minor in the first century AD. Secondly, they are viewed to be consecutive church eras, which span the course of the New Testament. And thirdly, they're viewed as representing different aspects of the church of God in the end time. After all, Revelation 1 tells us, blessed is he who keeps the words of this book. And throughout Revelation 2 and 3, we're told, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, plural. Revelation has been open to us at this time to understand. Therefore, we need to recognize the spiritual conditions represented in all these churches as being elements in God's church in the present day as we get closer to the end. Now, Revelation 3:10 is discussing the Philadelphian church. Let's see what the message, what that message Jesus Christ has for this faithful group. Revelation 3:10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Persevere here is the word we know from Mr. Fay so many times is hupomone. It's cheerful, patient, continuance. Jesus Christ promises that those who continue patiently in faithfulness to God will be kept from the hour of trial, which comes upon the whole earth, the Great Tribulation. Paul describes this patience in Romans 2 as patient continuance in doing good. Jesus, in the parable of the sower, describes it in relation to those who, quote, having heard the word with a noble and good heart, keep it and bear fruit with patience. That's Luke 8:15. There are character traits of those who will be kept from the hour of trial. This Philadelphian characteristic stands in contrast to the next church mentioned in Revelation 3, the Laodicean church. Their works are neither hot nor cold, we're told. That means that they're lacking in the patient continuance of doing good. They are not bearing the spiritual fruit with patience that Christ wants us to have. They don't see their spiritual condition as they really are. In Revelation 3:18, Jesus Christ advised them to buy from me gold refined in the fire. This message is very similar to that of the 12 virgins in Matthew 25, where the virgins who run out of oil are told, but go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves. We understand this buying is building godly character. We also understand these to be the remnant, which was not taken, those who remain in the Great Tribulation to be refined by the hour of trial. Let's see the godly characteristics of the who, again, defined one more time here in Zephaniah 2, verse 3. Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 3. Interestingly, Zephaniah means God has hidden. Zephaniah 2, verse 3. Seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. Seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. The who will be taken to a place of protection. The who that will be taken to the place of protection will be those who are faithfully striving to obtain God's righteousness. They will be bearing fruit. They will be doing good patiently. They will be enduring the spiritual trials of their lives and persevering through those trials. They will be keeping the testimony of Jesus Christ, living by his every word. And when they fall short, they will be striving to overcome, being transformed into the image and character of Jesus Christ. Now that we've looked at who God will take to a place of safety, let's look more at what exactly he is doing here. We see that from Revelation 12, the part of the what involves God bringing his people out of where they are currently located and helping them escape great danger. As we saw from the similarity of Exodus 19, God bore Israel on eagle's wings and carried them to himself. God spared ancient Israel from the suffering of bondage, bringing them out of the land of Egypt, a sinful land where they were being persecuted. God brought them out to be a holy people to himself. In Luke 17, Jesus Christ compares the time before his coming to both the time of Noah and the time of Lot. In the time before the great flood, the earth was wicked, we're told, and filled with violence. God decided, he said he was tired with striving with man and would start afresh with Noah and his family. In Genesis 7:1, the Lord said to Noah, "Come into the ark, because I have seen you are righteous before me in this generation." That sounds like a precondition to me. God brought Noah out of the land where he was and brought him into a refreshed world. He saved him by calling him to respond in faith by building an ark and by preaching righteousness through the work that God had called him to do. Noah entered the ark before it started raining. Lot's situation was similar. Lot was living in a wicked city, and God had passed judgment on that city and was going to destroy it, along with those practicing wickedness there. God sent two angels to take Lot out of that city before trouble began. The angels brought Lot and his family outside of the city. They were taken by hand, it says, by God's angels. Lot was told to escape to the mountains for protection. He actually lived in a cave immediately after he was taken away, even though we're told he lingered. And I think part of that lingering was the process of he was waiting for his son-in-laws to and his family to come out, but they weren't all going to do it. He had to make a choice to stand up and to do what is right in order to be taken. God took him out before it rained fire and brimstone. In each of these cases, it was necessary for both to stand up in belief and faithfulness and leave before the impending danger began. So it will also be in the days before Christ's coming. Let's see this by turning to Luke 17, verse 26. Luke chapter 17, verse 26. Jesus was speaking to his disciples here, warning his believers. Let's also be aware, as we read this, of the when here in regard to the place of safety as we're finishing up the what. Luke 17, 26. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so, it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Let's drop down to verse 34 here. And in verse 34, I'm going to drop out the words that are in italics here because those are added words by men, so I'm going to read it without that. Verse 34. I tell you, in that night there will be two in one bed. The one will be taken, the other will be left. Two will be grinding together. The one will be taken, and the other left. Two will be in the field. The one will be taken, the other left. And in verse 37. And they answered and said to him, "Where, Lord?" So in other words, they're saying, "Where are these people being taken?" So he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered. We're going to get more in depth in that verse later in a different part. But notice, where are they being taken? They are going to be taken. That is part of the what is occurring here. They're going to be taken out of danger. Just as Noah and Lot were spared, escaping the flood and escaping fire and brimstone, so will Christ's true believers be spared before the hour of trial that comes upon the earth. Jesus gives the example of some being taken and some being left, as I just mentioned. He is speaking of his believers before the coming tribulation. And as I said, they ask, where, Lord? Where will these be taken? The ones who are grinding, or the ones who are in the field, or the ones who are in bed? This is consistent, as I said, with the theme of escape, of impending danger, by those who were faithful to God in the past, the references of Noah and Lot. Jesus is letting his disciples know the same will take place before impending danger comes on the earth in the end time. God will take them out of where they are and bring them to himself, just like the Egyptians, or I'm sorry, just like the Israelites out of Egypt. God's people near the end of the age will also have to stand up in faith, just as Noah and Lot did. Okay, we see what is going to happen to God's faithful that are going to be taken in order to escape the time of trial that will come. Now let's look more closely at when. And we've kind of been hitting on the when a little bit here. There's a little bit of duplication. But what we read in Luke 17 is not describing the time immediately before Christ's return. We know that time is the day of the Lord. We know that during the day of the Lord, that men are going to be wanting rocks to fall on them, it says, to hide them from the type of things that are going on the earth. They're going to wish for death and not be able to find it, we're told. It will be a dreadful time of plagues sent by God on the wicked of the earth. Reading here, these people who are out in the field or who are working, they're grinding, doing things, or they're asleep in bed, it seems like they're in a rather leisured situation, not wanting rocks to fall on them. It's a little different feeling there. So we're told in Luke's timeline, what we're told there is before the beginning of the Great Tribulation, not before the immediate return of Christ. In Matthew's account of the Olivet prophecy, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation, let him who is in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go back down into the house. The abomination of desolation begins at the onset of the 1260 days. This is the beginning of the pagan Gentile sacrifice in the Holy Land, which begins, we're told, 30 days after the ceasing of the daily Jewish sacrifices, which will be going on. So the end of the Jewish sacrifices are at a 1,290-day period, we're told in Daniel 11 and 12. And then that 1260 begins the Great Tribulation. Therefore, the verses about some being taken and some being left is immediately before the beginning of the Great Tribulation. That's important because a lot of the world believes, or a lot of the Christian world believes in the rapture, and they think that that's occurring right before Christ comes back. That's not what's being talked about here. That's a misinterpretation or misunderstanding. Just as we see in Revelation 12, the church is nourished in her place the entire 1260 days. And again, hopefully that puts our timeline in the right perspective here. Okay, we've looked at who, what, and when in relation to the place of safety. Now let's look at the question of where. That's the one that's got the money in it. That's the big question, right? Just as Jesus' disciples asked, where, Lord, in regard to where those in Luke 17 would be taken, God's people in this age have also wondered where the location of the place of safety might be. We understand that we're told in Deuteronomy 29:29, it says, the secret things belong to God. But then the next part of that verse says, God has not given the rest of it, it says that, but those things which are revealed belong to us. So God has not given us unequivocal knowledge of the location of the place of safety, but we do, he does give us some clues about its whereabouts. And so I'd like to cover what the Bible does say about that here. Turn with me, if you would, to Isaiah 42 in verse 8. Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 8. And this begins as a prophecy about Christ. And just before our verse, Christ is prophesied to open the eyes of the blind and bring out the prisoners. Isaiah 42, 8. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. This reminds me of Amos 3:7. Amos 3:7, it says, surely the Lord does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. So he says, before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Verse 10, sing to the Lord a new song and his praise from the ends of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you coastlands and you inhabitants of them. Let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar inhabits. Let the inhabitants of Selah sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands. The Lord shall go forth like a mighty man. He shall stir up his zeal like a man of war. He shall cry out, yes, shout aloud. He shall prevail against his enemies. As we see in verse 9, Christ is telling us about something new. Something which is still to come. This is referring to a time at the return of Christ. That's when he comes back as a mighty man, like a man of war, at his return. It's a time when people give glory to God in a new song. It reminds us of Revelation. We're told a lot about a new song. Let's notice a couple other things here. Back in Genesis 25, we're not going to go there, but you'll find that Kedar is the son of Ishmael. The area described here is the Middle East. So Ishmael's descendants, that's where they are. So, and also it's described as an area, the area is described as a wilderness. We're told about inhabitants of Selah. Well, Selah means rock. So here in a future time, very near the return of Christ, people who live in rocks in the wilderness are shouting for joy at Christ's return. That's very interesting. It's also interesting, the Selah in Hebrew is the same word as Petra in Greek, rock. Let's see more about Selah by turning to Isaiah 16, verse 1. Isaiah chapter 16, in verse 1. Here we also have a prophecy about the future. Isaiah 16:1. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest. So shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Take counsel, execute judgment. Make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcasts. Do not betray him who escapes. Notice verse 4. Let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at hand. So there's danger here. Devastation ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. Verse 5, in mercy, the throne will be established, and one, capital O here, will sit on it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness. So So we see from the time frame here in verse 5 that Christ will soon be established on the throne of the earth, hastening righteousness. It's just before this time. But before that time, there's some adventure going on, we're told here. Sounds like it could be better than a Hollywood movie, whatever's going on there. We are introduced here to the nation of Moab. So Moab and Ammon were descendants of Lot. Moab, if you look at your handout here, on page 1 of your handout, you'll see a Moab is in purple, kind of dead center in the middle of the page, just slightly off to the right. It's just east of the Dead Sea. And the Arnon River is kind of, it flows into the Dead Sea from the east to the west. It flows into the Dead Sea about midway through, or towards the top third, I should say, of Moab. So that's where the Arnon River is. That's where, it's not marked, but if you go about a third of the way down the Dead Sea in that purple area, that's about where the Arnon River is. So that's where these people are escaping across. So we have women from Moab making their escape across the Arnon, and they're told, be careful, don't be spotted. They're to hide the outcasts, others who are escaping. I'm going to read an excerpt of Kyle and DeLeach's Bible commentary on Isaiah 16:1 here. Quote, the summons goes forth to the Moabites who have fled to Edom, which of course is the next nation down here on the map in the yellow, who have fled to Edom and even to Salah, i.e. Petra, Wadi Musa. We'll identify that a little bit later. Near Mount Hor in Arabia, Petra, to which it gave its name, to turn for protection. So there's no doubt here that these people are fleeing for protection in the area of Petra. In verse 4, God tells Moab, let my outcasts, capital M, dwell with you. Who are my outcasts? Well, these are people that God calls his own that are escaping at this time before the return of his son. They're coming from the north. They're escaping to the south from Moab to Selah, to Petra. Let's see more about Moab by turning to Jeremiah 48, verse 9. Jeremiah chapter 48, verse 9. Give wings to Moab. Sounds a little bit like the Red Bull commercial, right? Give wings to Moab, that she may flee and get away, for her cities shall be desolate without any to dwell in them. Let's drop down to verse 28. You who dwell in Moab, leave the cities and dwell in the rock, Selah, and be like the dove which makes her nest in the sides of the cave's mouth. So here we see a prophecy of Moab fleeing its own territory, which will become desolate, in order for some of them to dwell in Selah, like a dove in the sides of a cave. Cave dwelling in Selah, or Petra, by Moabite outcasts, who happen to be helping God's outcasts. Let's look more into Selah and what goes on there by turning to Isaiah 33, verse 13. Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 13. Hear you who are afar off what I have done, and you who are near acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He who walks uprightly and speaks uprightly. So again, here we go back to the nature of the type of people that God is going to be preserving. He who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hands, refusing bribes, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed and shuts his eyes from seeing evil. Verse 16, he will dwell on high his place of defense will be the fortress of rocks, Selah. Bread will be given him. His water will be sure. Verse 17, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. They will see the land that is very far off. Drop down to verse 22. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. He will save us. Of course, we know Jesus Christ is the rock as well, and that's where our ultimate protection comes from. God shows more of the characteristics of the type of people, as I mentioned, that he wants in his place of safety here. He who walks righteously and speaks uprightly will dwell in heights. His place of defense will be the fortress or stronghold of Selah or Petra. Bread will be given to him. His water will be sure. So just as God provided for the nation of Israel wandering for 40 years, if he can do that, he certainly can provide the bread and the water that his people, a smaller group of people, because that was over 2 million people from what I understand. There's not going to be 2 million people there, I'm quite sure. It's going to be a much smaller group, and certainly he can sustain them for 3.5 years. Let's look at another prophecy concerning Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Please turn with me, if you will, to Daniel 11, verse 40. Daniel chapter 11, 40. Daniel is speaking about the forces pressing against the Holy Land of Israel in the end times. Daniel 11, 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So as we see here in these kingdoms, Ammon north of Moab, and Moab north of Edom, this area is described as a safer part of the world because it's going to be desolate. It's not going to be inhabited there, and it's going to be to the side where the king of the north and the king of the south are pushing against the Holy Land. We understand the king of the north is an army that invades from the north, which we have historically believed is the beast power of Revelation. These will be the ones orchestrating the abomination of desolation that we talked about earlier. But notice here, as I said, Edom, Moab, Ammon is spared. They're safer. And as we see, or as we saw in Jeremiah 48, it's mentioned that that area is vacated. So it's one of the safer spots you could be in around there. Okay, we've looked at some prophecies. Let's look at a little history concerning the area of Selah or Petra. Let's turn to Numbers 10, verse 11. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. Here Israel is about to leave the area of Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb and move with the cloud closer to the promised land. Numbers 10, 11. Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year, so this is shortly after Israel would have left Egypt in the second year, that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. And the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So if we go to page 2 of our map now and look at page 2, and let's go towards the bottom right of our page, there you'll see Mount Sinai. There's a little blue triangle near Mount Sinai. And we have Mount Sinai listed down here. There's different Bible maps. We'll show you different things in different places, but I believe this to be the most accurate, because if Mount Sinai were in the Sinai Peninsula and God said he's going to bring Israel out of Egypt, then he wouldn't have been telling the truth if he would have left them in Sinai, because that was, as you can see from this blue squiggly line, running up from the Mediterranean and going down towards the Gulf of Aqaba there, that was the boundary line of Egypt. So the Sinai Peninsula, which is the area in between the Gulf of Aqaba and the Suez, which are the two forks of water going running up north, you'll see that big peninsula there, that's the Sinai Peninsula. But that's not where Mount Sinai would be if God brought Israel out of Egypt, which he did. So that little triangle area kind of in the bottom right, there is Mount Sinai. So if you go down from there, or I should say just straight east of there, you'll see the wilderness of Sinai in yellow. And then up from that, you'll see the wilderness of Paran, also in yellow. And then a little farther from that, and you'll see something called Kadesh Barnea, which we'll get into Kadesh in a bit here, which is the area that we understand is Petra today. Okay, so looking at that, page 2, we see the Brown Drivers Briggs Hebrew Dictionary defines Paran as place of caverns. So we know this wilderness area is a cavernous area. We follow Israel's movement. Let's do that by turning to Numbers 13, verse 21. Numbers chapter 13, 21. Moses is sending out the 12 spies to assess the promised land. Numbers 13, 21. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin. So if we stop here, we saw the wilderness of Sinai, the wilderness of Paran, then a little bit above Kadesh Barnea is the wilderness of Zin. So they're going to go and spy out the promised land, which is getting farther up north and going closer to the promised land. Let's drop down to verse 26 here. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So the spies, the people were waiting here in this Kadesh area while the spies went up into the promised land to take a look. And as the spies come back, they're coming back to this Kadesh, we're told, which is in the wilderness of Paran. Kadesh, according to Brown Driver Briggs, means holy. The people of God were waiting at Kadesh before they could enter the physical promised land. 10 of the spies gave a bad report, as we know, and 2 gave a positive report. But the ones, the people, after they received the bad reports, said, "If only we had died in Egypt." They rebelled and God made them wander for 40 years as that first generation died away. So let's pick up the story much farther in the future than in Numbers 20, verse 1. Numbers chapter 20 and verse 1. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there. So according to Kyle and Delitzsch's commentary, they placed Miriam's death around the 40th or in the 40th year of wandering. Moses, we're told here, this is the area where he struck the rock twice in order to bring forth the water. And at the end of this chapter, Aaron dies and is buried on Mount Hor. And you'll see on your map there, Mount Hor is just south of Kadesh in yellow. It's also got a little blue triangle, if you can spot where that is. So that was right there in that area where Aaron went up on the mountain and didn't come back down. Let's see one more point on Kadesh by turning to Deuteronomy 1, verse 19. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 19. Israel, we're told here, is in the 11th month of their 40th year of wandering now. So they're ready to enter the promised land. Deuteronomy 1, 19. So we departed from Horeb and went through all that great and terrible wilderness, Horeb, another name for Mount Sinai, and we went through all that great and terrible wilderness, which you saw on the way to the mountains of the Amorites. as the Lord our God had commanded us. Then we came to Kadesh Barnea. So previously, Kadesh was called Kadesh. Now it's called Kadesh Barnea. Strong's Concordance defines Barnea as wandering, as if by wavering. So if you have somebody that's kind of staggering, they're kind of wavering around, and that's what the Israelites did for 40 years. Back and forth, like a fugitive. After Israel wavered back and forth, zigzagging its way around different wildernesses, they returned back to Kadesh, now as the children of wandering. Kadesh, now called Kadesh Barnea, was once again God's staging area for his people before they entered the Promised Land. Wouldn't it be interesting if God once again used this wilderness full of caves as a staging area for his holy people before they enter a spiritual Promised Land? Even today, the Jordanians call the valley in the midst of Petra the Wadi Musa, the Valley of Moses. The Jordanians understand what occurred there in history and who was living in that land. So to wrap up, where, as Mr. Armstrong used to say, if the place of safety is not Petra, then its location is not revealed in Scripture. And interestingly, I think I read in one of those articles, Dr. Hay placed Petra or Selah or this area, Kadesh, it's mentioned third most in the Bible, only to Israel and Babylon. And I think, you know, you'd also have to throw Egypt in there. I don't know if he counted, but those four places you read about more than any other places, so it's interesting. Okay, we've looked at who will go to the place of safety, what it entails, when it will take place, and we've attempted to discern where it is. Let's look specifically at why a place of safety. Earlier in the what section, we saw how God protects his people prior to his involvement in major events, allowing them to escape danger. We saw this with Moses, Noah, and Lot, and we looked at Christ's words in Luke 17 about his believers would be taken in order to escape. Let's look at this escape and protection purpose again here by turning to Isaiah 26. Isaiah 26, verse 17. Isaiah is describing the anticipation of the people of God for the plan of God to be fulfilled. Isaiah 26, 17. As a woman with child is in pain and cries out in her pangs, when she draws near the time of her delivery, so have we been in your sight, O Lord. We have been with child, we have been in pain, we have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not accomplished any deliverance in the earth, nor have the inhabitants of the world fallen. Your dead shall live. Together with my dead body, they shall arise. Awake and sing, you who dwell in the dust, for your dew is like the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation is past. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will also disclose her blood and will no more cover her slain. So before God's people can have their dead rise, they need to first go back into their chambers. Chambers is defined by Strong's as an apartment. God's people, we're told here, will have their own little spaces, and they will hide there and let the fury pass. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has a great quote here in verse 20. Quote, when God is about to take vengeance on the ungodly, the saints shall be shut in by him in a place of safety, as Noah and his family were in the days of the flood, and as Israel was commanded not to go out of doors on the night of the slaying of the Egyptian firstborn, the saints are calmly and confidently to await the issue. God's people will certainly need protection through the Great Tribulation. God's people will also need protection and have the need to escape before the tribulation begins. Remember in Isaiah 16:4, God's people are described as outcasts. Let's see this theme again by turning to Isaiah 66, verse 5. Isaiah chapter 66 and verse 5. Hear the word of the Lord, you who tremble at his word. Your brethren who hated you, who cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Lord be glorified, that we may see your joy, but they shall be ashamed. Isn't that interesting? Brethren who hated you. These will be national brothers. Some of them may be familial brothers, our blood brothers. Some may even be church brothers. They hate God's true believers because of my name's sake. This reminds me of John 16:2, where Jesus says, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God's service. Let's see more of this persecution that needs to be escaped by turning to Mark 13, verse 7. Mark chapter 13, verse 7. And while we read this, let's keep that timeline in mind again here. Mark 13:7. But when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines and troubles. These are the beginning of sorrows. But watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in the synagogues. I'd mentioned in Chicago, can you imagine how eager we would be to come to church if you get punched in the nose to have to walk through the door? And you will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my name's sake and for a testimony to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all the nations. Let's drop down to verse 12. Now brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. So we see again, these events are before the Great Tribulation. This is in the period described as, these are the beginning of sorrows. They also occur before the abomination of desolation in Mark's timeline. God's people will be in a state of persecution leading up to that time. There will be a need for God's people to be taken out of this. So let's go back and now finish Luke 17:37. Jesus has told the disciples about one being taken and one being left, if we remember, in Luke 17 there, from bed, from the field, from grinding. So let's read verse 37 again of Luke 17. And they answered and said to him, where, Lord? So he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered. Well, I looked through just for fun. I wanted to locate my Harmony of the Gospels from Ambassador College, and I got that book out, and if you're familiar with that book, it puts all the Gospels together in a timeline sequence, so you can see if four writers write about the same thing, it's all there on the same page, or if three write about the same thing, it's right there. So I was able to locate that, and I wanted to just see what was written there, if anything, and sometimes I would bring a notebook and write my notes in a notebook. And sometimes, if I forgot my notebook, I would write in the book. So I wanted to see if what day it was. Did I remember my notebook that day or not? Well, It happens that I had the words scribbled here. And the words that I had scribbled, protection. And underneath that, I have the phrase, where the church is, God will protect it. So Jesus Christ is telling his disciples that he will take his believers to a place of protection in this timeline we're discussing. We see God's people will be outcasts, and they will need protection from persecution. There's also another element of why we must that we must discuss here. Do you remember in Exodus 19 where he says, God says he's going to bear Israel in eagle's wings and bring them to himself? Well, there's that same element in this statement by Jesus in verse 37 of Luke 17. What will Christ do when he brings his people to himself besides protect them? Let's turn and see where Christ is quoting from here, what he's referring to, by turning to Job 39, verse 27. Job chapter 39, verse 27. Job 39:27. Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock, Selah, it dwells and resides. On the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood. And where the slain are, there it is. So notice the eagles are gathered in the rock, Selah. There they have a stronghold, a place of protection. But notice in verse 30, they're also being fed there. They're being nourished, as we're told about in Revelation 12. The end of verse 30 is a little unclear. The word slain in Hebrew here means pierced. If we eliminate the italicized words again, it reads, where the pierced, there it, referring to eagles. So where the pierced one is, that's where the eagles are. The baby eagles will be where Christ, the pierced one, is, feeding on Christ. Just as we're told in John 6:55, Christ's flesh is food and his blood drink for his disciples. That same imagery here is in Job. We feed on him spiritually in order to become like him. That's the nourishing that's referred to in Revelation 12, the suck, the giving suck. Remember in Isaiah 33:17, just after we're told our bread and our water will be sure, it says, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. Remember, Peter, James, and John actually saw the transfigured Christ in Matthew 17. We're told here that Jesus' face shone like the sun. He was in glory. The disciples also saw Christ after he was resurrected, we're told. And in Acts 1, it says they were taught by him until he was taken up. Paul, we're told in Galatians 1, said, he wasn't taught the gospel by men, but received it by revelation from Christ. He learned this by being somewhere in Arabia for 3 years. Isn't it interesting? Somewhere in Arabia he went. If you go down that line from where Israel is down to where Arabia is, that's some familiar territory that we just looked at. Wouldn't it be fascinating and wonderful to be nourished and taught through the revelation of Christ in the place of safety? We've looked at the who, what, when, where, and why of the place of safety. But what about how? Well, we know that we will be taken, it said, on eagle's wings. And as Mr. Armstrong said on the topic, whatever that means. We have Luke 17's example of being taken. Then we have in the Gospels where Christ warns those in Judea to flee to the mountains, he says. Well, sitting here, probably most of us think, well, and those poor people that are going to be in Judea at that time. I hope I won't be there. I'm glad that's not us he's talking about, that we have to worry about leaving in the winter or on the Sabbath. So let me pose a question for all of us. If people hate and are willing to persecute God's church so much that they're willing to kill some of us, then isn't it conceivable that the United States at that time may want to just be rid of all of these troublemaking, problematic God worshipers entirely? If a country did want to get rid of people like that, who keep the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament, who keep the seventh-day Sabbath, who profess belief in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who might accept a people like that? So if something like that did play out, we wouldn't have to figure out where to go or how to get there or whether it's the right time or not to go. We may just be taken out of the land to a land where we may need to remember that phrase, those in Judea flee to the mountains. So, brethren, we understand the place of safety isn't the goal. We know that some of the faithful of God will lose their physical lives. We don't want to be focused on the saving of ourselves. But Christ does tell us to pray that we may be counted worthy to escape. That worthiness is what our job is now as Christians. We need to keep the word and bear fruit with patience. We are encouraged knowing God has promised and planned deliverance for his people. Just as he made a way of escape for Noah, Lot, and Moses, so he has made a way of escape for his end time people. That way of escape brings his people to himself, where we can be nourished to become more ready for his service. Let's be like those eagles feeding on Christ now, so that we can be useful tools in his kingdom. Brethren, there is a great tribulation, and there is a place of safety.